synagogue, going to church, health, you know, therapy, whatever. None of that worked for me. It could work for someone else. It just didn't work for me. I needed this program. But who am I to say that this is the only thing that's going to work for you? All I know is that this has worked for me. And I can't say that this is the only way to get sober, because I don't know. I don't know that there's other ways to get sober. We have no monopoly on that. But I know that this is that's worked for me. And this is where I found my solution, my higher power, my ability to live happy, joyous, and free. And now we're going to skip to the third edition, forward to the third edition, again, talking about we're growing, more languages, more bigger, we're everywhere, we're getting big. And this is 1976. We're talking about just like how we're growing and how it's now, there's lots of countries and now there's people who are under 30. And the last paragraph is what I think is, you know, is what really speaks to me is, despite how big we are and how we are, you know, coming up everywhere, is that at the core, this program actually remains simple and personal. And each day somewhere in the world, recovery begins with one alcoholic talks with another, sharing experience, strength, and hope. And again, this is just my blueprint. This is how I talk to one alcoholic to another, sharing experience, strength, and hope. And as a quick word about the fourth edition, forward of the fourth edition, is, you know, it talks about this whole like information age, and I got sober in 97. So the internet was just like a blossoming new idea. Lots of chat rooms, lots of late nights on coffee talking about that kind of thing. And, you know, I couldn't imagine what it would be like to have all this information thrown at me and trying to get sober at the same time. But I do think that, you know, having the internet as another tool just to carry the message. I mean, how many times have I been at work where a sponsee has called me and I've asked them, do you have the book? And they're like, no, I don't have my book with me, which is awful. And, because I carry mine everywhere, of course. And then I can say, okay, go online and Google Big Book and it's right there. You know, okay, go to page blah, 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 and read this right now to me out loud. It's everywhere. There's no excuse, you know, and I could see how it could get like kind of confusing. Do these, you know, are these meetings different than those meetings? Does this count as a meeting? But I've heard so many people that they came into the rooms because they started chatting with someone online. You know, I often am out of town and I can't find meetings, and I'll go online and I'll find a meeting book for some, you know, town that I've never been to online. I have, you know, the Big Book online, you know, doing research in history online. It's such a great tool, but it's just one tool, and I would hesitate to even use it as my only tool, but it's definitely a tool that's in my spiritual toolbox that I get to use, that, you know, push comes to shove and I really need some connection, you know, what a gift to be able to have that technology at my fingertips when I need it, when I most need it, because you just never know. Like, God speaks to me through my computer as much as he does, you know, through all of you. I mean, he really does. So that's all I have to say on the forwards.
Thank you very much. Just going back to the first forward, most of us coming to Alcoholics Anonymous have been told by doctors or people that care for us and love us that we are, you know, we need to do something. It is impossible to deal with a situation unless we know exactly what we're trying to deal with. Up until Dr. Silkworth wrote this open letter to members of Alcoholics Anonymous, the majority of the public believed and truly believed that alcoholism was a moral problem. Why can't this person just stop? What is the problem? You know, Dr. Silkworth came up with this brilliant solution, which was absolute rocket science back in 1935, that there is something wrong with the alcoholic. There is something sick with the alcoholic. There is something physically wrong with the alcoholic. What an amazing concept. And in the first foreword, it says, as Liz laid out with, many do not comprehend the alcoholic is a very sick person. What we're going to study for the next half an hour is Dr. Silkworth's opinion. And we have to remember that it is just an opinion. Here is a man who was a medical man. He was not an alcoholic. He chose to work in the field of alcoholism addiction, really before it became the blossoming industry that it is today. So this is just his opinion. Now, a couple of things about the foreword. Right after that sentence where they describe the alcoholic as a sick person, they say, and besides, We are sure that our way of living has its advantages for all. Our way of living is written up here, the 12 steps. That is why, after Alcoholics Anonymous became workable, after people saw that people were getting clean and sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, there were other 12-step programs that came along, because the standard for any kind of recovery from whatever it is, and here we're only talking about alcoholism, but any kind of recovery or just a generally much better way of living is available to us. And it's available to us, as Liz said very succinctly, if we use this book as a textbook. Liz also talked about opinions. In 1955, when the second edition of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, was published, the doctor's opinion was moved from chapter one to a chapter all of its own. I have an opinion about that, mm-hmm. as to why it is not the first chapter, because I don't know any alcoholic on picking up a book when they did that opened the book and started reading from the very beginning. You read a book, you read a novel, you read a textbook, you want to get to the core of it right away, so you go, where's the first chapter? Where's the first chapter? Okay, chapter one, here we go. As I said, I have no opinion as to why the doctor's opinion was moved. The doctor in question, and I'm sure you're all aware of this, but the doctor in, doctor in question was William D. Silkworth. He was a well-known doctor who treated alcoholics in Towns Hospital in New York City, which, and a big speak out for the Upper West Side, was on 90th Street and West End Avenue. It's now a condo or condominium. There are several people who, on the anniversary of Bill Wilson's leaving that hospital for the last time, gather there the evening of that and hold a small candlelight vigil. I live right around the corner from that, and I've partaken in that. And it's really cool. I met people from New Jersey, from South Virginia, who came up just to be there for that hour or so. Let's get down to the meat and bones of the doctor's opinion. What are we going to get from this? What are we going to be able to walk away from reading the doctor's opinion? And in the very first paragraph, it says we are going to witness our return to health. Therefore, that tells us right away that we are sick people. We are not morally wrong people. Yes, we may be. We're not stupid people. Yes, we may have done stupid things when drinking. But the main core is that we have this allergy to alcohol. When it comes into our system, phenomena take place. And we're going to discuss these a little more in depth.
Can I just pump in, yes. come in real quick? I was also, you know, what Roger was saying, how this was like rocket science back in the day. Like, nobody had ever said that this was an allergy, that there was anything wrong with us physically. And I think, you know, we're going to go on and talk about how, like, leaving the picture of the physical aspect is an incomplete picture of what's going on with us. No one back then, like, this was the first time it was ever said that this was an allergy, that, you know, we have an allergic reaction, you know, so much like, you know, strawberries where our throats close up, or like peanuts where we get hives. Like, we have an adverse reaction, and we're going to go into that some more, but no one had ever said this. This was revolutionary. Like, oh my God, I'm bodily different. Like, I just can't, it's not just all, I mean, of course it centers in my mind, but it's not all in my mind. There's a physical difference. And this was like earth shattering.
And Dr. Silkworth was invited to write a letter, an open letter to everybody that would read this book. And it starts off, the second paragraph of the letter says, in late 1934, I attended a patient who, though he had been a competent businessman of good earning, was an alcoholic of a type I had come to regard as hopeless. A hopeless alcoholic. Most of us in this room, I know for me personally, at the end of my drinking, I could be described as a hopeless alcoholic. In the course of his third treatment, now I find this interesting that it says that, because I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and since 1994, I have not had a drink. That's me. There are many people that have come to Alcoholics Anonymous. There are many people that have gone to treatment centers who have not been able to realize what their situation is on the first, second, third, or fourth time. When I read this, in the course of his third treatment, this is the person who we now look up to as the founder of our organization. He didn't get it the first time either. So mm-hmm. just because I did does not make me or anybody else who went to treatment and came out and stayed sober any different. We are not that special. We have to learn that we are fallible human beings. Dr. Bob stopped drinking, went on a binge, and then never drank again. Bill Wilson was in Towns Hospital for the third time. So none of us are fallible, and those of us that have stopped drinking on the first go-round should consider themselves just lucky. You know, we are all fallible. We are, you know, those who do that are nothing more special than an alcoholic, which is what we all are. As part of his rehabilitation, and we're talking now about Bill Wilson, he commenced to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others. What does that mean? What does that really mean? And what it meant was that basically Bill Wilson spoke to another alcoholic who had a drinking problem, who wanted to not drink, and he didn't. If we read this book all the way through, there is not one single instruction in this book that tells us how to stop drinking. It doesn't give us the answers. It gives us the answers, but it doesn't give us, you know, you must do this, you must do that, you got to stop that. There's no way. When I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I realized this was all about not drinking, I wanted to go to the paragraph where it told me exactly what I have to do and not drink and, you know, thank you very much and I can go on with my life. There's not one paragraph. There's 164 pages. But there is no recipe. There is no direct instruction on how to stop drinking, which is why Alcoholics Anonymous truly works, because it means one alcoholic talking to another. When doctors told me that I didn't need to drink, when doctors told me I shouldn't drink because my liver's going out, when my parents, who loved me dearly, told me that I'm destroying my life, I paid absolutely no attention to them, not only because I'm a selfish, self-centered alcoholic, because I couldn't believe them. When a man who had nothing in common with me whatsoever, apart from the fact that he was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, sat down and told me his drinking story and what he did, my ears pricked up and I paid attention. And the first thing he read to me when he gave me that copy of that big book was he told me that I have a disease. I don't want a disease. Nobody wants a disease. We think of diseases as, you know, cancer. We think of diseases as, you know, other physical, mental, other physical things that go on with us. But alcoholism is a disease. We who have, and we go to the right after the letter. First of all, we have to remember that this book, Alcoholics Anonymous, is a PIP, P-I-P. It contains prayers, information, and promises. Not just the promises that we expect to find after the ninth step, but promises throughout the book. And that was pointed out to me. And it says here, I believe, on page XXIV, in the second paragraph, we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe that the body is of an alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. So right there, two stingers right in a row, one after the other. My body's abnormal, my mind's abnormal. Did not want to hear that. It did not satisfy us to told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life.
Even though we might have been.
Even though we may well have been. And this is the first of many, many musts in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And then he goes on to explain his theory. The doctor's theory was that we have an allergy to alcoholism and it interests us because we're now being offered not a solution at this point. We are now being offered education as to why we behave the way we do. And that's very, very important. Because if we don't understand why we behave, why we do, then there's no chance of us even looking anywhere to find not a cure, but to find a reprieve from that. Because we can recover, we are recovered. I'm recovered from the symptoms of alcoholism. I am never recovered from being an alcoholic. I will be an alcoholic until they throw dirt on me. And any time I pick up a drink, I'm in trouble. And many of us have unfortunately learned that. We doctors, and here we go on page XXV, we doctors have realized for a long time that some form of moral psychology was of urgent importance to alcoholics. I mean, this is a doctor using medical terms, but he uses very strict, strong words. Urgent importance to alcoholics. We have to realize that we have a physical problem. one of the things that Bill did was, and further down on that page, was he requested the privilege of being allowed to tell his story to other patients. When you are asked as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous to speak at a meeting, we have to really remind ourselves that it is a privilege that we are given. It really is a privilege. We don't just sit there and waffle through our drunkologues and then go, you know, when I found an AA meeting, thank you very much, have a good night. It's a privilege to tell our stories of how we learnt about what our problems were, how we were able to find a solution to them, and how our lives have changed continuing to use that solution.
Can I just say something about that paragraph? In that same paragraph, he talks about the unselfishness of these men as we have come to know them. The entire absence of profit motive and their community spirit is indeed inspiring to one who has labored long and wearily in this alcoholic field. Now, I don't know about you, but when I came in, I definitely had profit motive in mind. I had zero community spirit. It was all about Liz and what could I get and what was I not getting. And to hear that that can change, that I can become that type of person, to be selfless, you know, not selfish, that I can not look for what can I get out of you, but actually just come to you with hat in hand, how can I be of service to you? Like that is such a great promise for someone who comes in racked in self, bondage of self. So that is just such, that's something for me to look forward to, that is possible, that I can change.
Thank you. On page XXVI, the last paragraph, it says, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. My sponsor always told me when it says men, women, A, I, us, to always cross that out and put my name in. So when I read this book through with a sponsee, I realize that I drank essentially because I like the effects. Where was I going to go with this? Okay. Next we have the description of the alcoholic life. Restless, irritable, discontent. That's all we had. We had nothing more than that. We may have had some passages, some moments, but generally speaking, when we look back at it, honestly, our lives were restless, irritable, and discontent until we could gain that extra something from that extra little bottle that we drank the next time around.
Can I just say something real quick? So to talk about the restless, irritable, and discontented, it says, unless we can again experience the sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Now, you know, it only seems like I'm getting ease and comfort when I take a couple of drinks. It's only a sense of it. I'm not actually getting ease and comfort. I get ease and comfort from my higher power, and I'm getting ease and comfort from this program, but it's just a sense of it. So that's why I have to keep drinking, because that sense is like fleeting and soon lost. It's gone. As soon as I start sobering up a little bit, it's gone. I need that sense again and again and again. It's not actual ease and comfort that I'm getting. It's just a sense of it. It's like a false illusion of what is ease and comfort.
And on page XVII, it mentions a phrase twice. That phrase is psychic change. I'm sorry, I'm reading left-handed and talking right-handed. What actually is a psychic change? What actually is that we have to respond to? And that is a complete change of thought process, an absolute complete change of thought process which gets totally turned around. He also says, I do not hold with those who believe that alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control. And as we go over to the next page, XXVIII, he describes the very first time the classifications of alcoholics. I'm not going to read them out exactly as they are written, but there are five types there. I urge every single one of you after this little meeting is over to read this and determine which one, two, three, four, or five of these apply to you. Because there's a majority of people here, and I know for me, there's more than one description that fully describes me as an alcoholic. All these people, depending on what you self-diagnose your description is, have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. He then goes into a detailed description, and he gives several experiences of other people that have been to visit him, And this is, again, proof positive, before we even start looking at how the program of Alcoholics Anonymous works, that even this gentleman, not an alcoholic, a doctor, believes that telling you a story, telling you how somebody else did something, is of far more importance than him sitting there saying, this is what you have to take this prescription. It holds far more weight with each and every one of us when somebody tells.
This gentleman right here is from the state of New Jersey. And if you're from the state of New York, you have an opinion about the state of New Jersey. All right? I mean, they have, you know, they have very strange names for a lot of their towns, like Weehawken, Hoboken, Secaucus, Hohokuth. And they have even one, my favorite is Piscataway, you know. Very strange names. But, you know, about 7 years ago, I was introduced to an area in New Jersey, which I had never heard of, never been to, called Netconk. And that's where this gentleman comes from, Netconk, New Jersey. And I was taken out there for a unity breakfast that a number of groups put on together out there, right? And I saw a groups out there in this part of New Jersey that had pockets of enthusiasm for their groups, their program, and their AA life out in New Jersey. And I was impressed, and I've been going back almost every year since then. And I also go out in January when they have their anniversary meeting. And this year they're having Clancy, and who else is coming out?
Dick Martin.
Dick Martin, and who? Gary Peek is sponsored in January. So if you're in the New Jersey area, go out to Netconk and listen to these guys. So this, and I met this gentleman at that time, and we've stayed in touch on and off through the years. So I'm very happy that he's here to do this weekend. And his name is Doug. And this gentleman, his name is Joel. And Joel, as I mentioned earlier, chaired this event, this big book study, 3 consecutive years. And the first year he chaired it, he asked me to be one of the panelists on the big book. So I kind of felt like obligated to ask him, you know what I mean? I mean, I felt like I had no choice, you know. Actually, you know, I started preparing for this, I say, 9-10 months ago, and he was the first name that popped in my head to ask to be a panelist. That's the truth. So I'm very happy that he's here. He's a member of my home group, and his name is Joel. So please give a welcome to Doug and Joel on the second step.
My name is Doug Peganick. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Doug.
And because of the grace of God, the actions I've learned to take here in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have not had a drink since November 3rd of 1979. And for that, I'm very, very grateful.
My name is Joel, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Joel.
I'm a member of the Atlantic Group. I became a member of the Atlantic Group because I asked Van to be my sponsor back in, I think it was 91 or 92. And I said I wanted to go through the big book the way Joe and Charlie had presented it. The prior 10 years when I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, we were working this the program off the shades, you know, off the steps off the shades behind us. And I thought that I was different because I was an adult child of an alcoholic, and I went to those meetings, and I went to every kind of 12-step program there was out there. And after 10 years, I was crazier than a bed bug. And somebody said to me, are you working the program of Alcoholics Anonymous? And I said, what do you mean am I working the program? I go to meetings. He said, no, have you done what it says in this book? And I went to Joe and Charlie's seminar. I don't know if it was the first or second one where I met Van, and I wanted to go through the work the way, because I knew he was a big book thumper. And he said, I'll be your sponsor, but you have to join my home group. And at that time, Atlantic Group was about a year old. And I've been coming ever since. You know, this book contains a lot of information, and I find the best way to really get to the meat of this book is to sit down one-on-one with your sponsor, read about a paragraph or two, and talk about it, chew on it a little bit, you know, go back and forth with it. I also have a strange relationship with this book. I never think I know enough about this book until I start trying to teach it. And when I try to teach it, then I start learning. It's like that's one of those paradoxes of AA. If you want to, you know, keep your sobriety, you have to give it away. You have to show up and try and help another. And I think it's the same thing with this book. If you want to learn this book, I think the best thing you can do is try to help someone else with it. Sit down with it and start explaining it. Having said that, I don't think an hour is enough time to really cover the information that we need to go in here. So we'll just go over and gloss over what Bill's story is about. Bill, when he was putting together the formula for this book, he was 3 years sober at the time. There was a lot of ideas floating around with Dr. Bob and Bill counted heads, and they realized there was 40 sober alcoholics. And they said, hey, we really got something here. And they had a lot of ideas, like they wanted to open up a chain of hospitals. They wanted to they had a bunch of ideas. But one of the ideas that came to fruition was writing this book. They said, we need to write this book because we realize that this message that we have is now starting to get garbled. And I don't know if any of you have ever played that game called Telephone, where you whisper to this guy, you know, a certain phrase, and by the time it gets to the 25th person, it's all cockamamie, all different. It's not the same message anymore. So they said, we need you to codify this message and write it down in this book. And a few things happened. Bill realized that before he wrote this book, that his first successful transmutation of the message was with Dr. Bob. And before doing it with Dr. Bob, he had tried and tried and tried for 6 months to get alcoholics sober. And he was failing miserably. He just couldn't get anyone sober. And two important things happened from non-alcoholics. We owe a lot to non-alcoholics who contributed to this program. One came from his wife, and the other came from Dr. Silkworth. And he came home one day very distraught and said, you know, I'm not getting anybody sober, and you're supporting me. You know, I think I got to give up this venture and go back to Wall Street and try and make a little money. And Lois says to Bill, oh, no, Bill, you're wrong. You're dead wrong. He says, what do you mean? He said, you've been sober. And he got it. He got it. In order to stay sober, he had to help another or try and help another. Whether he was successful or not didn't matter. And then the other thing he did was he paid a visit to Dr. Silkworth. And Dr. Silkworth said, oh, yes, yes, Bill, I heard about your shenanigans. You've been going into bar rooms, taking them off the bar stools, grabbing them, you know, to these Oxford group meetings, making them go in the front of the room and do confessions and surrenders and all this kind of stuff. He said, you got it all backwards. He said, you're giving them the solution first. What you need to do is what I did for you. He says, give them the facts. Tell them about how this disease is a hopeless state of mind and body. That was one of the things I hope was covered. I don't remember if it was covered succinctly, but that's our definition of alcoholism. It says in our preface, in the foreword, excuse me, you know, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. A hopeless state, that's our definition. Now, why do we call it a hopeless state of mind and body? You know, everybody knows nowadays, you know, you got a problem with alcoholism, you go to the hospital, you know, and they're going to sober you up and send you to AA. 1935, there was no, drunks were despised. Unless you had some money, they threw you out of the sanitariums. You could go to a sanitarium or, you know, you had no place to sober up. It was, and doctors didn't want to call. Dr. Silkworth also called us hopeless. So that's our definition, a hopeless state of mind and body. So he learned from the doctor the true nature of this malady, you know, that we have a physical allergy coupled with a mental obsession, you know, and this physical allergy only happens in alcoholics. It doesn't happen in the average Joe Blow population. And some people are born with it, they're alcoholics from the get-go, and some people develop it over time. But the one thing that differentiates all of us in this room, if we're real alcoholics, from everybody else, is if we have one drink, we're going to be looking for another. You know, that sets off that phenomenon of craving. We no longer we've lost the power of choice when it comes to drink. And then the other part was that we have a mind that's broken. You know, that this mental obsession is so powerful, it lies to us. This is the definition of insanity, as far as I'm concerned about AA, this inability to leave it alone. We can't differentiate true from the false. Our mind will say, you know what happened to me last night? You know, it was that group of people I was drinking with. If I didn't hang out with that crowd, I wouldn't have gotten drunk. Well, you know what? I switched drinks. You should, oh, if you stick to one thing, you drink it. Oh, I put ice in it. I should drink neat. Whatever it is, it'll tell us a lie, and we'll stop picking up the first drink, which sets off the phenomenon of craving, and on we are, off to the races. So Bill was armed with this information when he approached Dr. Bob, right? He had these two pieces of information, that he needed to talk to another alcoholic in order for himself to say so, but not he wasn't there to save Dr. Bob. He was there to save his own tush. You know, he knew that this, from his wife, that this was the kind of work that kept him sober. And he also knew from the good Dr. Silkworth that he needed to go first and tell him the facts, you know, and present it in such a way that he could hear it and say, I'm not here to help you, bud, but this is something I need to do in order for me to stay sober. Would you please listen to me? You know, this is what I found has kept me sober for the last 6 months. And Dr. Bob was able to take the cotton out of his ears and be receptive and hear a medical opinion from a layman. You know, just think about that. You ever try to tell a doctor anything medical? You know, but because it was one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic, and we have a way of communicating with each other that we know when the bull is flying, you know, the little BS flag goes up, but we know when somebody's telling us the truth and it's coming from the heart, and we can listen and we can communicate in a way. Well, what Bill did when he organized his book, he did the same exact thing. The doctor's opinion was on page one, chapter one. I do have an opinion about why it got changed. If you ask me, I'll tell you during the break. But where was I? All right, he put the doctor's opinion first so that the alcoholics would have they realized that this book, and there's only 40 of them, and they realized that this book was going to have to do the job that Bill was doing on a 12-step call. So the very first 12-step call they received was reading this book. And if you don't believe this is the message, one more thing I wanted to point out that was earlier. Everyone asked, what's the AA message, you know? And it's on, hold on, I fold it down the page. I'm okay?
I can jump in here.
You can jump in. You want to jump in?
Yeah.
Go.
Let me go. You know, Joel asked me just before we started if I was nervous about this. And the thing that I love about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was extremely nervous when I got to AA to begin with, but over time, what I found is this is the safest place in the world for me to be, is in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I appreciate the fact that there's been others that have sat at this table this morning and spoke. Because I learned a long time ago that I'm the type of guy that when I come to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, my body may be there, but it takes me about 15, 20 minutes from my mind and my heart to get into that meeting. And my mind and heart is in this meeting now because of the things that other folks have shared that I've identified with. And I think the only thing that made me a little nervous this morning is when Ron was talking about, or somebody was mentioned getting out to the outlets. And I want you to know my wife is there now, and I'm a little concerned for you folks. There won't be anything left. But Bill's story, I first encountered that, and when you think about that, and this is, you know, in years in hindsight, you step back and you look at that story, and you see how it starts. And he starts out with how, you know, life was just opening up to him, you know, and things are going to be great, and he was going to be, you know, the guy that was going to achieve everything, and he's going to be the number one man, and you know, and he writes that in those pages, and then he encounters this brick wall called alcoholism. And by the time you get to the middle of that story, what you're hearing is a guy that, you know, was on top, he's at the bottom, and he's lost. He's lost everything. They're locking him up in mental hospitals. See, and when I read that story the first time, it's like, you know, conceptually I could identify. I didn't grow up in New York or Vermont, for that matter. But I could understand about, you know, wanting to rise to the top, you know, that I wanted to be somebody in this world, and I wanted my peers and my family look at me and say, you know, this guy's wonderful, you know. And then I encountered that obstacle. And when I encountered that obstacle, it took me down to where I ended up in a mental hospital, you know. So here it is. I identify, and I think that was so critical when Bill, as Joel was talking about, when Bill went to talk to Bob, he learned something. You know, he learned that it became important for him to convey what his experience was, and hopefully that would convey enough of an identification to take place that this guy would want to come along with him. And it worked. You know, and I believe that the same thing that Joel's talking about is that to be most effective, I think, in Alcoholics Anonymous is you set with this book, you know, and you take the guy or gal through one-on-one, because that's what Bill Wilson learned, you know, is that one-on-one, you know, you can help another man or woman, you know. And so to stay close to that idea as we go forward and as we go through these studies, I love these types of things. I've learned some things this morning from my old friend from New Jersey and his wife that I really identified with. And so these are very valuable things that we experience here. Did you remember what you wanted to say?
Yeah, no, okay. I got the page. No, about the AA being the message, you know, what is the AA message? It used to be on the jacket cover of the third edition, but I've lost mine years ago. But if you ever find a jacket cover, let me know. I'd like to write that down exactly verbatim. But it says here on page XVII, I got the third edition. It was found to the astonishment of everyone that AA's message could be transmitted in the mail as well as by word of mouth. That means the book is the message. The message was being transmitted by mail. So anyway, he sets up this the book the same way that he brought the message to the Dr. Bob. He figured first you give him the hard facts. That's why the doctor's opinion is first. And then you qualify and you try to get them to identify. Now, how do you identify with Bill? You know, because Bill, he was, I think, in his mid-30s when he wrote this book. He's a Wall Street lawyer. He's white. He's from Vermont. He's male. You know, so a lot of people could find a lot of things not to identify with. But I was told when you read this, try to identify with his...
Old Alcoholics Anonymous that doesn't have a program of recovery and is primarily fellowship, we probably won't stay there very long either, because we'll find out that just abstinence by itself will not do the trick. What it'll do is it'll fill our heads full of thoughts that we had that we used to take a drink to kill. And then we'll eventually have to drink just simply so we don't have to think that way anymore, unless we have a message that has depth and weight. And I think Bill's story is a message of depth and weight that says, you know, this is what happened to me, and here's a solution that I found for what happened to me. And he talked about God. You know, and that's one of those topics that when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, in fact, I just experienced it today. I was standing there waiting to sign in, and I saw some of the books that were laying on the table, and one of them said, you know, A Sinner's Return to God. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I sobered up in the state of Kansas, and I want you to know a lot of people from the state of Kansas are pretty religious folks, and I really believe that my ending up in Alcoholics Anonymous was a moral issue, you know, that I was a bad guy. You know, I'd done a lot of terrible things. In fact, I broke all of the Ten Commandments, and I'm not proud of that. It's just that's what happened, and because that was my litmus test of, you know, how well am I doing in life, and I began to break those rules, I felt so denigrated. And then I ended up in a mental hospital. And when I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, my first thought was that this is a religious program, you know. I'm going to have to do something with this God deal in order for me to overcome. And my only concern when I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous was one thing, and it really wasn't overcoming drinking. It was, how do you stay out of the nut house? I wanted to know what you needed to do that. And the people that I was around, they laid the simple kit of spiritual tools at my feet, and they said, what you do is that you go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, you get a sponsor, and you work the steps. And when you do those things, you know, you won't have to come back here, except we'd like maybe you to come back as a visitor from time to time. And I want you to tell me, those men that told me those words, it was the absolute truth. You know, I've never been back to that nut house since I became a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and done the things that are laid out in this book. So when we're approached with the idea of a power greater than ourselves, you know, when we talk about that second step, because I see I'm convinced that I'm powerless. And I think that the only way you're ever going to accept step two is if you're convinced that you don't have any other solutions. You know, when they said, you know, you can either go on to the bitter end or you can accept spiritual help, I says, there's got to be a third answer, you know. There's got to be a third one. I'm going to go look for it. You know, and Fortunately, I didn't have to go out and drink and do any more damage, but I destroyed myself on the inside mentally and emotionally because I didn't have that solution, because I had this old idea that no one's going to tell me how I was going to live my life. See, and I came into Alcoholics Anonymous with that idea that I'm going to determine those things. And this whole book is a different idea than what I'm used to. You know, I'm used to running my own show. And here it says the results were nil until we let go absolutely. You know, and what are we talking about letting go of? The old ideas. You know, and I believe that step two is really about letting go of a lot of old ideas. You know, what old ideas do I have? You know, my old idea is that, you know, if you weren't raised in the Catholic Church, you're going to have a hard time getting into heaven. You know, especially if you were Catholic. And I had old ideas about, you know, drinking in itself. You know, I believe that every man should be able to drink as much as he wants, as long as he wants. And I had to let go of that idea. So there was a lot of old ideas that over time I've been able to release because of the ideas that are in here. I've replaced those old ideas with these new ideas, which really aren't new ideas. They're just the accumulation of a lot of folks' wisdom over the ages. Joel?
Again, I don't want to get too bogged down in Bill's story, but I think it contains a powerful lesson of progression and the way he thought. I just want to just outline that everybody using that formula could identify with his thinking and his drinking. On page 2, it says, I proved to the world I was important, right? And I nearly failed my law course at one of the finals. I was too drunk to think or write. I thought my drinking was not yet continuous, but it disturbed my wife. We had long talks where I would still her forebodings by telling her that men of genius conceived their best projects when drunk, that the most majestic constructions of philosophical thoughts were so derived. I call that stinking thinking, and I had that kind of thinking. You know, but you can see now he's into problem drinking, and then it progresses. On page 3, my drinking assumed more serious proportions, continued all day and almost all the night. Right. It just keeps on until he's finally on the part on page 5. Liquor ceased to be a luxury. It became a necessity. A tumbler full of gin followed by a half dozen bottles of beer would be required if I were to eat any breakfast. Nonetheless, I still thought I could control the situation through a period of sobriety which renewed my wife's hope. Gradually, things got worse. Like it was getting not getting any worse. Then I was on the pretentious bend. I woke up, this had to be stopped, etc. It goes all the way through. I think the most important part, though, of Bill's story is when Abby Thatcher comes and brings the message to Bill. And this will be a nice transition into the next chapter. There's a solution. Because Abby Thatcher was an old friend of Bill. He drank like Bill. He was a worse souse than Bill. And Abby Thatcher turns up at his door one day, and he's sober. What he didn't know was that Abby had been 12-stepped by a man by the name of Roland Hazard. Actually, he was paroled to Roland Hazard and Seabrook Graves, I think, and had gotten locked up here in Vermont. And Seabrook Graves' daddy was the judge. So there was a little something going on. Okay, we'll parole him to your care. Roland Hazard had gotten the solution. We get the problem from Dr. Silkworth, but we get the solution to alcoholism from Dr. Jung. Dr. Jung talked about Dr. Silkworth talked about entire psyche change, but Silkworth was more direct and more forward. He said a vital spiritual experience was necessary to bring about this psychic change. You know, Silkworth knew we needed the psyche change. He didn't know how it was going to come about. But in There's a Solution, we learned that Roland Hazard gets the message of this vital spiritual awakening from Dr. Jung. He takes this message, gives it to Abby Thatcher, and Abby Thatcher, in turn, is taught the six tenets, and one of them was what he had to go out and give this away. So he says, I'll go see my good friend Bill, you know? And he takes a trip from Manhattan, takes a, you know, whatever the trolley cost. You know, it cost money to get sober, by the way. You know, it's not just money in the basket. You had to put a nickel in the trolley or whatever it was, go cross town and go visit Dr. You know, go visit Bill. And Bill, I think, was this was after his second detox. He's in between his second and third detox. And amazing thing happens. They get into this conversation with each other about, well, you know, Bill was curious, what got into you? And he says, I got religion. And he says, what is it? I was aghast, you know, a bit balmy about the, you know, I got to look up the words. But this, if they're having this argument, and I believe AA was born during this argument, and they're going back and forth saying, you know, Abby Thatcher saying, if you want to stay sober, you got to find God. And says, I don't want to find God. I hate religion. I don't want no preachers telling me anything. And they're going back and forth, back and forth. Bill knows he's got something that Abby Thatcher, you know, Thatcher has something that he wants, but he's not willing to you know, swallow this I got religion idea. And then all of a sudden, Abby Thatcher has a brilliant idea. He says, Bill, why don't make it a God of your understanding? And you can make it anything you want. You know, and that turned this religious idea, which was the Oxford Group movement, into a spiritual idea. You know, that we could choose our own understanding of God. And
along that's on page 12 actually in the book, and that is when we're talking about, you know, the old ideas. It says here that my friend suggested what seemed a novel idea. You know, why don't you choose your own conception of God? And it was, you know, shortly after in the italicized words just below that, I think a paragraph or two down, it says, it's only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required of me to make a beginning. And as long as Bill held on to the idea that, you know, he was going to beat this thing, and that was his greatest enemy, was that he thought he could beat alcoholism. But it had to, you know, the recognition that he was powerless, and then to step out and say, okay, I will choose my own concept of God. That really appealed to Bill, and he began to think about those things that his grandfather had taught him. You know, about the music of the spheres, if you will, that God could be personable to him. And personal to us.
Let me go on with that. Because we now, you know, Bill had taken step one a couple of pages before when he talks about that bitter morass. But I'm, over here, though, he takes step two. Upon a foundation of complete willingness, I might build what I saw in my friend. Would I have it? Of course I would. I believe this is here when Bill takes step two. He became willing to believe in a power greater than himself. You know, the powerlessness made him willing. You know, the foundation, you know, of our program is powerlessness. You know, how do you become willing to change, to come into the, you drink more whiskey. You know, mm-hmm. Step one is not worked in these rooms. You work it out there. You know, so he came in here completely defeated. You know, he knew he was totally powerless. He saw an example of God working through this other individual, although he didn't want to call him God, but he knew he had something that he wanted. And so he became willing to pursue what his friend had.
Absolutely. And a little further down on that page, he talked about, at long last, I saw, I felt, I believed. Scales of pride and prejudice fell from my eyes. A new world came into view. And again, he began to let go of the old ideas. And he began to have the much-needed spiritual experience in order to overcome alcoholism. Do you want to move to?
There's just so much stuff in Bill's story. I mean, before he had a spiritual awakening, he did the steps. They're on page 13. You know, I awfully humbled myself to God as I understood Him to do with me as He would. I placed myself unreservedly under His care and direction. I admitted for the first time. That of myself I was nothing, that without him I was lost. Step three. I ruthlessly faced my sins. Four. Became willing to have my newfound friend, capital F, that's God, take them away root and branch. That's six and seven. I have not had a drink since. My school friend visit me. This is when he's in the hospital. Third visit. I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiencies. Step five. Made a list of all persons I had hurt and became willing to make to as I felt resentment and expressed my willingness to approach these individuals, admitting my wrong. Never was I to be critical of them. Steps 8 and 9. I was to write all such matters to the utmost of my abilities. Steps 8 and 9. All right? I was to test my new God consciousness within. Common sense would become uncommon sense. Step 10. I was to sit quietly when in doubt, asking only for direction and strength to meet my problems as he would have me. Never was I to pray for myself, except as my request bore on my uselessness to others. Then only might I receive, but it would be in great measures. Step 11. Now, what I find amazing is we see the 12 steps here. They're not written until chapter 5. You know, he already knew, you know, which direction he had to go in, and that the six tenets of the Oxford Group movement was not going to fill all these loopholes. And then we turn the page, and then we realize he has this great white light experience. Talks to the doctor, and the doctor says, I don't know what you had, but whatever you have now, you better hang on to it. There's a very important warning on the bottom of page 14. Faith without works was dead, he said, for how appallingly true for the alcoholic. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life to work and self-sacrifice for others, he would not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. And if he did not work, he would surely drink again. And if he drank, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead indeed. With us, it is like that. It's a strong warning, but it's also a theme that you're going to see repeated throughout this book. You know, that we have to constantly think of others and try to give this thing away. And that's how we grow spiritually, by work and self-sacrifice for others.
As well as a warning, it's also, I think, very much a promise that, you know, if you take the action of reaching out to others, that it is probably the greatest mechanism that I've ever discovered to help smash self-centeredness. As others have said here this morning, is that when I spend time trying to, you know, convey this message, try to get people to identify, try to get them to understand what their condition is so that they can then hopefully move forward and begin to accept a power greater than themselves, an amazing thing happens. Is that, and it was you saying it, when you're teaching this, as I go through that, those actions, what happens is that for just a brief moment, self-centeredness kind of slips far enough to the side to where God slips in for just a couple of minutes. And that experience of having God in my life because of working with others is the same type of elation that I used to get when I took a few drinks. And one of our great friends has said, you know, that AA does over a long period of time what a drink used to do very quickly. And that if we will, you know, continue to enlarge on our spiritual life, you know, through helping others, that we can replicate that over and over again. And that's been a great discovery and a great promise of the book. Do it over and over again, and what happens is that you get happy and usefully whole. But you must be willing to help others, to take that time out of your life. As somebody had mentioned, you know, even if it's a little bit inconvenient, it's really necessary to go help others, and the rewards are just immeasurable.
Okay, we've got to move on. There's a solution. Now, this chapter, I believe, is going to rehash a little bit about what happened before so we understand we have a hopeless condition of mind and body, and then it's going to introduce the solution a couple of pages later. But first kind of just gets us home. But there's a strong warning. You know, there's two great powers in AA. There's the power of the vital spiritual experience, which is the promise that we'll have this awakening as a result of these steps that is stated in step 12. And then there's the other power. The fellowship itself has a power. There seems to be something that happens when we all get together, you know, but that in itself, you know, having that common peril, you know, that would not keep us sober. And here's the warning. The feeling of having shared in a common peril is one element in the powerful cement which binds us. But that in itself would never have held us together as we are now joined. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have had discovered a common solution. We have a way out which we can absolutely agree, and upon which we can, in brotherly and harmonious action, join in harmonious and brotherly action. We can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. So there's a warning there and also a promise, I mean a great promise, that this common solution is what's going to keep us together. This sort of illness, and we've come to believe it is an illness, involves us in about a way that no other human sickness can. If a person has cancer, all are sorry for him, and no one is angry or hurt. But not so with the alcoholic illness, for with it goes annihilation of all things worthwhile in life. It engulfs all whose lives touch the sufferers. It brings misunderstanding, fierce resentments, financial insecurity, disgusted friends and employers, warped lives of blameless children, sad wives and parents. Anyone can increase the list. So us alcoholics not only affect ourselves, but we affect all the people around us. We're like the tornado roaring through the lives of others. And it continues to talk about how horrible this disease is. But there's so much on this book. It says in italics, I've always told to pay attention to the squiggly writings. But the ex-problem drinker who has found this solution, who is properly armed with the facts about himself, that means we know about the doctor's opinion, can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours. Until such an understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. There's a warning there. That the man who's making the approach has had the same difficulties, that he obviously knows what he is talking about, that his whole deportment shouts at the new prospect that he is a man with a real answer, that he has no attitude of holier than thou, nothing whatever except the sincere desire to be helpful, that there are no dues to pay, no axes to grind, no people to please, no lectures to be indoors. These are the conditions we have found most effective. After such an approach, many take up their beds and walk again. What a wonderful promise.
Sometimes I go to what I call contemporary meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and so what I do is I have my big book with me, and I make little notes in them. In the chapter there is a solution, I believe, also the chapter more about alcoholism. The number of times Bill describes what type of alcoholics we are, and the verbiage that he uses is really interesting, and I think it's in the doctor's opinion. Well, they talk about the allergic type, you know, the real alcoholic, the true alcoholic, the hopeless variety, the seriously alcoholic, the type of alcoholic, able and willing to get well, alcoholics of our type, and alcoholics of our kind. The description, I think, is what he's trying to convey to us, because Bill, from what I understand, was a type of guy that he liked the English language, and he liked to repeat himself a lot, and he used to describe us with different words just simply to make the same point over and over again. I find that the real alcoholic, and I've heard people, they'll introduce themselves that I'm a real alcoholic, and I know that offends some people. When you introduce yourself as a real alcoholic, that means that I'm not, I guess. But the point is that unless, again, you're convinced of the alcoholism as being the crux of the problem for us, the solution of seeking out a higher power is meaningless, because we won't go there. We'll stay focused on that I am somehow going to work my way out of this problem. I'm going to try every method that I can think of, and whether it be money or sex, and those seem to be the ones that every time one of my guys calls me, that's what his problem is. Which is very enlightening to me, and entertaining. Coming back to the solution of, go work with another alcoholic, find that power greater than yourself, come to believe that power will relieve you of your alcoholism. And of course, there's many, many things that we have to do in addition to just that thought process. You know, it's taking those appropriate actions. Joel?
Again, I love the book because the book says it so much better than I do. Please forgive me if I read from the book a lot. You may already be asking yourself what it is that all of us, you may already be asking yourself why it is that all of us became so very ill from drinking. Doubtless you are curious to discover the how and why, in the face of expert opinion to the contrary, we have recovered. Is that nasty word, recovered? You know, you talked about, you announce yourself as a real alcoholic. Everybody gives you a hairy eyeball look. Go around announcing yourself as a recovered alcoholic and see what kind of reception you get. You know, and this book uses the word recovery very freely. It promises recovery. I'm in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, clean and dry, for 26 years. For me to go saying I'm a recovering alcoholic, what kind of message am I sending to the newcomer when I say that? After 26 years, you know, coming to rooms, I'm still recovering? No, I've recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body. Doesn't mean I could drink safely. It simply means that I have the spiritual toolkit available to me on a daily basis that I'm pretty confident I won't drink today. You know, I've recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body. You know, as long as I'm taking care of the mind, I take care of the mind by going to God. I brought my problems to God. God took care of my mind. I was trying to fix me for so many years, and Joe and Charlie said, you can't heal a sick mind with a sick mind. And finally, after about 10 years in the program, I got it. But anyway, that recovered word jumped out at me. From a hopeless condition of mind and body, that's our definition of alcoholism. If you are alcoholic and want to get over it, you may be already asking, what do I have to do? It is the purpose of this book to answer such questions specifically. We should tell you what we have done. This book is our guide. This is our roadmap. This is a recipe book, whatever, you know, for staying sober, the directions are in here, first 164 pages. All right, then they talk about different kind of drinkers. All right, it's good to try and find out where do you place yourself in this drinking world, you know, to diagnose yourself. Moderate drinkers have little trouble giving it up liquor entirely if they have good reason for it. They can take it or leave it alone. I'm married to one of those. She'll order some wine at a restaurant, take a few sips of it, and put it down. And all night, the night will go by. I'm eating my dinner. So why aren't you drinking that? You know, why aren't you drinking that? And she says, I don't like the taste of it. It totally blows. I didn't care what the taste was. I always drank for the effect, not the taste.
Such a waste.
What? That's called alcohol abuse, isn't
it?
Yeah.
It's terrible.
Then there's a certain type of hard drinker. He may have the habit badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally. It may cause him to die a few years before his time. If a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, or the warnings of a doctor become inoperative, this man can also stop or moderate, although he may find it difficult and troublesome and may even need medical attention. We meet these people all the time. Some of these people are even in our rooms. They were ordered to come into our rooms by the, you know, they got a DWI. The judge said, you go to the AA meetings. They come into the meetings. You know, they could stop or moderate if a sufficient reason comes along, the warning of the judge. You know, you do this one more time, you go into the USCAP, and they're in our rooms. What kind of message do you think you're going to get from these heavy drinkers? You think they have to work the program as hard and as diligently as the real alcoholic? And now we're going to learn about the real alcoholic. But what about the real alcoholic? He may start off as a moderate drinker. He may or may not become a continuous hard drinker, but at some stage in his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink, and that's because of the allergy. Here's the fellow who's been puzzling you, especially his lack of control. He does absurd, incredibly tragic things while drinking. He's a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He is seldom mildly intoxicated. He's always more or less insanely drunk. Now, if you identify with any of this, could you, like, raise your hand? You know, every time I say something here, that's what Joe and Charlie little trick. I like that, though. His disposition while drinking resembles normal nature but little. He may be one of the finest fellows in the world, but let him drink for a day, and he frankly becomes disgustingly and even dangerously antisocial. He has a positive genius for getting tired at exactly the wrong moment, particularly when some important decision must be made or arrangement kept. He's often perfectly sensible and well-balanced concerning everything except liquor, but in that respect, he's incredibly dishonest and selfish. And he often possesses special abilities, skills, aptitudes, and has a promising career ahead of him. Yeah. But this stuff basically is so that I could identify with this. Okay, I got this physical. We're still talking about the physical craving, the physical allergy. Page 23, though, we turn a corner. We're going to move from the physical allergy to the mental obsession. It says, these observations would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. That shouts like thunder in my head. You know, and 5 minutes. Okay. That sounds like thunder in my head because no matter how long I drank, you know, and I used to go on binges, you know, for a couple of days, whatever it is, you know, just drink, get up in the morning, whatever it is. At some point, I got to stop. My body's just saying, stop. You know, you need rest. You know, you're dehydrated, you know. And when I wake up out of that with the sweats and everything, all the rest of it, that cold hangover and that nasty feeling, I'm sober. I'm cold, stone, sober at some point. And my mind tells me to pick up that drink. So where does the problem, where's my problem? If that's my broker, tell him I'll call him back. Where's the main problem really exist? Is it in my body that can't safely drink, or it is in my mind that can't prevent it from coming into my body?
You know, and just to kind of finish up with the chapter two, you know, have you all tried to figure out where that certain point is? You know, in the book it talks about that certain point where we cross a line and we can't come back. Yeah, you know? And again, it's talking about the powerlessness over the ability to, you know, choose whether we drink or don't drink. That has been. We've lost that ability, and once we lose that ability to choose, that means we're completely powerless. You know, and it's accepting that idea. You know, that first step, that we're powerless over alcohol, then sets us up for the next phase, which is, you know, coming to believe in that power greater than ourselves, so that you know, we can step into, as Bill called it, the sunlight of the spirit. And I think throughout 2 and 3, chapters 2 and 3, it goes on to reinforce, you know about the peculiar mental twist that we have already acquired and will always win out if we don't have some solution for the powerlessness over alcoholism. And there was, and I know because we're running a little short on time here, on page 37 in the book, you know, I'm going to just dwell on this, the mental aspect, as Joel had opened it up, is that about in the middle of the page says, you know, we can't recall the consequences, but there was always a curious mental phenomenon that parallel with our sound reasoning. There inevitably ran some insanely trivial excuse for taking the first drink. And he uses that word, insanely. And, you know, in our step, it says, you know, can't believe a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And to me, that's the sanity we're talking about. We're not talking about the insanity of me being in a nut house, you know, because that's what I associate insanity with, is that I'm going to be locked up in a nut house because I'm whacked, you know. The insanity is that when it comes to drinking, I don't make good choices. I don't choose at all. I simply drink. And that mental blank spot that precedes those first drinks, it was baffling to me. Is that why couldn't I stop? Why couldn't I live my life like I saw a lot of other people living their lives? Why can't I drink like my wife, who can take 2 glasses of wine at dinner and go home and fall asleep? You know, and that's the biggest outcome that ever comes out of those 2 glasses of wine. Whereas me, you can read into that.
Uh,
worse for me, you know, two glasses is like, you know, we're closing this place down. You know, that's where I'm going. So anyway, that powerlessness, that insanity that we deal with, the second step is the purpose of that is, you know, to believe in that power that will begin to relieve that insanity so that we, you know, realize we don't choose. You know, we don't choose whether we drink or don't drink. That was lost a long time ago. And now we need something greater than ourselves in order to replace, you know, what used to be, you know, our own willpower.
Yeah, I'm sorry I spent so much time reading. I never got to my favorite page, which is page 25. Meet after the meeting, you know, I'll discuss why it's my favorite page. The bottom of that page is step zero. And if you're curious about that, I'll tell you about it later. But just to conclude this, Bill's like just hammering it home. You know, this insanity of alcoholism. We have this no effective mental defense against picking up the first drink. You know, our defense must come from a higher power. He just hammers it home until he introduces that wonderful chapter, We Agnostics. And just before that, I'd like to close with that paragraph. It says, once more, if you didn't get it, right? The alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink, except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power.
Here.
You hear in these rooms that this is, you know, you hear a lot of people saying that they go to AA, that that's page 43. You hear a lot of people say that AA is a self-help program. No, AA is a God-help program. That's what that statement says.
His
defense must come from a higher power. Thank you.
This young lady, the first time I came up to Vermont and came to the Wilson House, I believe was her first time that she came up as well. And we were inseparable that weekend. We went everywhere that weekend. We had a great time that weekend. And because I got to know Heidi so much better at that time, I got to know a lot of other people in AG a lot better at that time that we came up on this weekend. And it just leaves me with great memories, and it was also propelled me to come back to the Wilson Hat because of the great time I had with her that particular weekend 7 years ago. So, you know, so Heidi's going to speak tonight. She's one of the panelists. And Steve, this gentleman from Staten Island, when I first walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, he was sitting in that room that I went to when I was counting days. He would sit in the back against the wall with his cohorts. We call that inventory row. And during the qualification, they would be back there talking. And then at halftime, when they would go to the secretary's break, him and his cohorts would get up, leave the room, go outside where their six motorcycles were parked, rev up those motorcycles as loud as they could, and disturbed the meeting when they were going down the street. But then I think something happened to Steve, which happens to a lot of people in AA. Don't drink and go to meetings wasn't just enough, you know. And sometimes people get spiritual experiences in the rooms. And I saw that happen to this guy, you know. And I know he does a lot of big book studies in his home in Staten Island. And I know he takes a lot of guys one-on-one personally through the book himself. So don't drink and go to meetings, I guess, wasn't working for him. And he had to find the book and the program contained within. So I'm really happy that he's here today to do this with us. So please help me welcome Steve and Heidi.
Hi, everybody. My name is Heidi, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Heidi.
Hi there. I'm probably going to be rearranging this microphone, but I'm really, thank you so much, Ron, for asking us. It's such an honor and a privilege. My sobriety date is September 3rd, 1990. I have a sponsor. I have a home group. I sponsor others. And I, just to get some particulars out of the way, I got sober 3 days after my 16th birthday. And so I was definitely taught that it's important to identify with the feelings and what alcohol did for me. and not necessarily the particulars. I started drinking when I was 11 and was quickly pickled, as I like to say now. I just, you know, I can't imagine. I wasn't thinking about turning 18. It was, you know, just very quickly downhill. And I was fortunate to fall in. I had about nine months of dry time, you know, of just really, you know, not drinking and going to meetings and hanging around with, you know, good hairstyles and interesting clothes. And, I was quickly miserable. I was quickly, you know, and I didn't know what was wrong with me. I didn't know that I would identify myself as an alcoholic or I would just say I was a, you know, whatever, because it was nonspecific, you know. And the truth is that I didn't understand my problem, you know, and that's what we talked about earlier today, is what the problem is. And at about 9 months sober, I found a group called the Here and Now Group. And I was really, I didn't know that there was another way. I thought it was either drink or kill yourself, you know. And what I love, I don't like that term that was referred to earlier about people who are excited about the big book. So we say big book enthusiasts. And you know, that's definitely me, and I think my awesome partner Steve too. I think that's pretty much it. Like, I basically just couldn't stop drinking. I found myself at 14 making deals with myself, and you know, trying to stop for 2 weeks, and then you know, finding myself drunk the next day. You know, several stories, and it'll all come out as we move through the book. But we're excited to get right into it. So grateful to be here, Steve.
Hi, I'm Steve Margarella, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Steve.
And it's an honor and a privilege to be here, and I want to thank Ron and y'all for asking me. And I want to just say that, you know, Liz and Roger and Joel and Doug just did an amazing, amazing talks this morning. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Every time I get to a microphone, I have, like, my alter ego is Vito DeLand.